Welcome to Coffee House Shots for Spectator's Daily Politics Podcast. We've just had a rather extraordinary session of Prime Minister's questions that ended with John Bercow, the Speaker, being given points of order for over an hour. The MPs were in uproar, but what about and what does it mean? I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So, James, you spent rather a longer session than you expected in the chamber. I cannot remember scenes like this. Tell us what's just happened.
So, essentially, word came this morning that John Bercow had accepted an amendment from Dominic Grieve to the business motion ahead of this debate on Theresa May's Brexit deal today. That came as a big surprise to people because people didn't think that any amendments laid by anyone other than a Minister of the Crown could be accepted.
Well, but this is we're talking about Dominic Grieve's amendment, which would do what?
Which would force the Prime Minister to come back within 3 days if her deal is defeated, as it surely will be, with what her plan B is.
Well, people expected this amendment to come sometime or another. So why is there such a controversy that it came today? Why did this end in this one-hour slanging
match? There is such a controversy because, as John Bercow himself admitted, there is no precedent for the decision that he has taken. He has essentially changed the rules of the House of Commons unilaterally.
But does it matter that much? If you're going to have this debate one way or another, does it really matter what mechanism was used to have it?
It matters because, as with the Yvette Cooper No Deal Amendment, it matters for what it foretells about the future. It is essentially John Bercow saying that he is prepared to unilaterally change the procedures of the House of Commons, and that obviously has huge implications for Parliament's for what Parliament can and cannot do on Brexit. Because if he is getting the suggestion today, which Bercow conspicuously did not deny in the chamber, is that the clerks had advised him against accepting this amendment and Bercow went ahead and did it anyway.
Right.
If we are in that kind of situation where the Speaker is going to behave in such a manner, that has big implications for what is going to happen on Brexit between now and March 29th.
So, Isabel, it seems that John Bercow has pretty much said that he will make up the rules of the House of Commons as he goes along. Is that what's getting to people? The idea that Bercow is saying that he's got the power to change the rules, so he will change the rules?
Yes, and not only that, but that he hasn't really thought through the implications of this. I think one of his most instructive responses was to Jacob Rees-Mogg, who stood up and asked for him to think through the implications of changing this. And Bercow's response was, "I will reflect on that," which doesn't suggest a particularly considered decision has been made. And Bercow all but admitted in the chamber that the reports that he had been advised against accepting this amendment by the clerks were true. And this shows, as James says, that Bercow is basically saying, "I can do as I please." And there were obviously, there were Tory MPs for whom this is a decision that is inconvenient, who were complaining about this. But this isn't just about what happens with this particular amendment or indeed what happens with Brexit. It's also about what a future Speaker can do and about the neutrality of the Speaker's office in general. And that's something that Bercow was still pontificating about in the chamber today. He was in his sort of full Dickensian flow as he was responding to all these many points of order. And he was talking about how he had always performed his role with responsibility and he never avoided a challenge and that sort of thing. But this is a big change, even from the way that Bercow has conducted himself, I think.
And Isabel, is this something that anybody should care about outside of Westminster? Is this just MPs getting their knickers in a twist about how the Commons works? Or does this have larger implications for how Brexit might develop and indeed how government might develop?
Well, it does have bigger implications, and it's very tempting for people, I think, within Westminster to sort of show off and suggest they're in touch with the real world by saying no one outside Westminster cares about this. Well, quite often no one outside Westminster cares about anything that's going through the House of Commons until it might affect them personally. And I personally think that's the way a representative democracy should work. That's MPs' jobs, is partly so that we can get on with the rest of our lives, or at least the people whose jobs it is don't have anything to do with Westminster, unlike us. But I think also that there is an implication of this particular amendment, which, as James explained, it gives the government a deadline of just 3 days after the Brexit vote to explain the new plans if that meaningful vote does, as expected, fail to go through. And so this speeds things up quite a lot, and there's a reason that Brexiteers don't particularly like it and that those who are trying to stop Brexit do like it, and that was another facet to this debate in the Commons. But I don't think it was just a debate about who likes and who doesn't like Brexit. This was, as James says, also about the procedure and about the Speaker's authority. And just another facet of the argument this afternoon is that John Bercow's authority has already been seriously undermined by the Dame Laura Cox report on bullying and harassment in the House of Commons, which basically said that he should resign because the failures of the House of Commons authorities went all the way to the top and there wasn't really any prospect of change without the current leadership leaving. And I do think that this argument this afternoon would have been far less furious had it not been for that report and for John Bercow's refusal to resign in the wake of that.
Now, James, the future of Brexit to a large extent does depend on these parliamentary mechanisms. For example, it's often said of as no majority for no deal, but it's due to a parliamentary mechanism that no deal is the default position unless Parliament votes for something else. So that is when these rules and regulations of the House of Commons can actually come to determine the future, because the government is sitting here trying to plot a path. The government's opponents, who want a second referendum, who want a general election, all of these hopes and plans depend upon parliamentary mechanism. Now, so far, we've sat in this room discussing various things, all based on what's possible under parliamentary rules. So are you saying that as of today, this has become a lot less predictable?
I think it has become... Well, I think this was factored in a way, which is that John Bercow will push the rules, I think. I think you could say that he has possibly exceeded them today, in that if you've got to a situation where, to draw a parallel, this is like a government minister being told by his permanent secretary that something is not a good idea and not allowed and doing it anyway. This is essentially what's happened with Bercow today. When you have, when those guidelines that govern our kind of unwritten constitution, when those are removed, things become much more unpredictable in what will happen. I think one consequence of this today is one government minister was saying to me just after the points of order that, you know, the next time any government returns with a decent majority, say, you know, a majority of 40 or 50, they will put a patsy in a speaker. We are going to go back to the 18th century and highly partisan speakers.
Right, because if a speaker is prepared to override the rules, he can do that under governmental pressure.
Exactly. So they will seek to... So I think what we will now see, the ironic legacy of the Bercow speakership is that any government with a decent majority will try and put in a pliable loyalist into the chair and hope that the vote on the government side is large enough to do that, because they will look at how Bercow is behaving and think, we're not going to risk that again. We're not going to risk an independent speaker. And in a way, this whole convention that we've had over in recent decades of this impartial speaker is going to end up going up in smoke.
Right. And Isabel, you're saying that many MPs think he should have resigned as a result of the report into bullying in the House of Commons. Also, I think he himself gave a timeline for where he would resign as Speaker, a timeline which is now passed. So do you think a lot of the anger is in the fact that they actually thought he should have quit in disgrace months ago, if not this time last year? And yet, not only is he hanging on, but he's becoming bolder than ever before.
Yeah, he's a bit like one of those TV dramas that's really good for the first sort of four series. And then when you get to the fifth one, it doesn't make any sense anymore. And it starts to be more and more outlandish in order to try to get attention. John Bercow has made so many really good reforms to the way that Parliament operates. He's supercharged backbenchers. He's ensured that select committees have more power. The use of urgent questions has been really important for parliamentary scrutiny. But like so many people, or just to go back to the TV series analogy, good things, he appears to have outstayed his welcome and to have become, I think, almost complacent in the post as well. There's a lot of frustration, for instance, around the length of time that PMQs takes. And you might say, well, that's just people trying to get out early in time for lunch. But actually, Bercow hasn't extended that session to the good of Parliament. It's just basically so that he can waffle on a little bit longer. And he doesn't really police questions so that they are difficult for the Prime Minister. It's just it does seem to be a way of him increasing sort of the airtime of the biggest session without any real benefit to democracy. And so it's a shame, because it undermines his good earlier work, that now his career is sort of mirroring to a certain extent Michael Martin's at the end of his career as Speaker. If you look back to the row in the Commons over the police raid on Damien Green's office, for instance, and then of course the expenses scandal, you saw Michael Martin arguing from the chair with MPs and desperately trying to call the House to order. Now, we haven't quite got to the point where Burko is struggling on a sort of minute by minute basis to keep order, but we're not far off from that now. A lot of MPs today, all on the Tory side, it has to be said, were saying that they don't respect his authority anymore, and that's quite a dangerous place for a speaker to end up in, no matter how good they've been over the years.
I have to say, James, I wasn't in the chamber, but I was watching it on TV. It looked as if order pretty much collapsed there. MP after MP standing up pretty much to denounce the Speaker. Now, we know that if there was a poll of MPs, most of them would want him gone anyway. There have been talk about whether you should depose him. Under the British system, MPs aren't allowed to criticise the Speaker. But I wonder if there's going to be an upshot to
Most MPs don't want him gone. But the problem is the why most MPs don't want him gone. There is a narrow majority in favour of Burko. And some people have said this very publicly. Because essentially lots of MPs think we're going to override all of the things that we know he has done wrong. Isabel talks about the Laura Cox report into bullying and the criticisms it made of the Commons as an institution. Because we think that what Burko will do on Brexit is more important. Mm. And it's that sense of partiality that I think is the real problem here.
Because he's seen as anti-Brexit. And we do things to frustrate the government.
Some people, Margaret Beckett, Ben Bradshaw, spring to mind. People have talked explicitly about how, you know, that Brexit is more important than any of its other stuff. So Burko must stay as Speaker. I think for that reason, he is seen to be party pre. And look, in an ideal world, a Speaker would command the support of a whole House. At the moment, it is quite clear that there is a large chunk of the government benches, including the government front bench, that basically have no respect for him. You watch the government front bench as Burko was explaining his actions, and it's their obvious disrespect for him. Now, you can say, oh, that problem's a government's problem, but there is a problem with the House of Commons when the Speaker is a kind of referee-style figure. And if one side think that the referee is biased, it is a problem, and you do need to find a way around that. And I think there is Burko has brought a lot of trouble on himself. You know, for example, he told people which way he voted in the Brexit referendum. Yeah. There was absolutely no need for him to do that. You know, don't let sunlight in on the mystery. You could have just sat there and no one could have known. And again, I think one of the reasons that the points of order took so long is that Burko replies with such long answers. He would chastise any government minister who consistently gave such long answers. And I think John Burko is part of a modern problem. It is about him. You know, people laugh at the get-up that speakers used to wear with the wig and all this stuff. But if that was because they weren't sitting in the chair, their office was. But for John Burko, it is all about him. And someone said to me, he's the only speaker whose official portrait has him talking. And that is the problem with John Burko.
The speaker who speaks too much. James and Isabel, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes Store, or you can subscribe to Spectator Radio, our kind of greatest hits channel, which has got not just this podcast, but our Americano, Arts and Culture, our books, and our Table Talk podcasts. Also, if you'd like to subscribe to the magazine itself, we've got a offer, which is, in my view, ridiculously underpriced. For £12, you not only get 12 weeks of The Spectator and 12 weeks of access to the website, but you get £20 worth of John Lewis vouchers, which adds up to a grand total of -£8. Now, yeah, I kind of, from a commercial perspective, hope you don't take us up on this offer. I've no idea how they authorised it. But if you want to, it's on spectator.co.uk/voucher.